union meeting of this office and professional workers union.
Okay.
She had been become a member before I did, and I went to this meeting. Here was this very attractive woman, and she announced in this meeting that she had been appointed chairman to study something and needed some members of the committee, so I volunteered. Next thing you know, we get engaged and married. But she was, she came from a poor family. A Marxist would, what would a Marxist call, not petty bourgeois, sort of lower middle class. Their old man had a job all during the Depression, but it wasn't much of a job, right at the bottom of the management hierarchy for a big private utility company. But she was a sorority girl and had all the middle class attitudes. Her mother was pretty well, came from a fairly well-to-do family. But she had gotten a job after she finished college in an organization in Seattle which did research for unions to support their demands for wage increases and, you know, that kind of thing, where she was thrown in with a bunch of left-wing secretaries who educated her. And so the time came when there was a state legislative committee looking for Reds on the University of Washington campus, and she and I took the lead in organizing an ACLU branch there. And when we went to New Haven, we found out there was no ACLU branch there, and we helped organize that one. And we went to Salt Lake City, there's no ACLU, so we organized a branch there. And she went along with me and would be the secretary of the local branch, that kind of thing. Which is why I think she thought getting a law degree was an appealing idea. But as I think back on it, God, we found out there was no law school here. And she could have gotten into U of M, I'm pretty sure, with a good first year at Utah. Mm-hmm. But she didn't like the idea of driving back and forth, especially in those days. To go to here, from here to Ann Arbor, it was all two-lane highway.
Grand River, you know. Probably.
Yeah, Grand River, and dangerous as hell in any conditions, but especially like now. So she never pursued the career in the law after that. Mm-hmm. And I think that contributed a lot. We were divorced after 24 years of marriage, and I think that had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. The climate on campus when you first got here, how would you describe it? In 1956.
I used to complain to Walter all the time. We got to be friends pretty quickly after I got here, about what a hick place this was. And, you know, roofs all over the damn place. The term foreign student at that time meant somebody from out of state.
Out of state.
And I noticed in the springtime, I'd see it was women students walking across the campus wearing raincoats when it was hotter than hell. Mm-hmm. And I asked somebody, well, why the hell do they wear raincoats? Oh, they're going to the gym, and they've got gym shorts. They're wearing gym shorts, and the university doesn't think it'd be appropriate to be walking around the campus in skimpy gym outfits. So they wear raincoats. Walter, so I said to Walter, you know, I got to get out of this damn place and get back to the West Coast, with a more civilized atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So for about 10 years, I kept writing to people out there saying, if you know of a job that pays well and doesn't have too require qualifications that are too impressive, let me know. So I would get an inquiry now and then, but nothing I really wanted to pursue anyway. I think it took me 10 years finally to realize, and Walter used to point this out, if you think this is a hick place, you should go to some other school and find out that they're all the same. And I should have known it, because I went through a red witch hunt at the University of Washington. There was a similar kind of activity going on at Yale while I was there, and I was involved in both those. Now, Utah was a pretty good place from the standpoint of protecting the faculty. But then there were no Reds in Utah.
They assumed that there were no Reds in Utah.
There weren't any here either. But, anyway, I had a low opinion of Michigan State. On the other hand, I could see that it had a lot of promise. This building program that's going on now must impress newcomers. but it was even it was at least as active as it is now. Back in those days, every month there seemed to be a new building springing up somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I went to one of the. We used to have meetings of an organization called the Faculty Senate. I don't know if it even exists anymore. But this was a body to which everybody in the tenure stream was invited to attend. And Hannah, who was president then, would use this as an opportunity to give a kind of state of the university address. There was no discussion. Nobody ever offered motions or anything. You just come listen to this icon. And of course, they called him Uncle John back in those days. Mm-hmm. He was revered and feared at one and the same time, I think. Mm-hmm. And I took a dislike to his management style, as you might guess. I look back on him now, I'd call him a benevolent despot. Mm-hmm. But there were very many rules that you had to abide by. You see, all that stuff's codified now, and you've got the faculty handbook and this, that, and the other. None of that existed. It was all done on the basis of sort of the handshake or something, which was kind of attractive. But I remember one time, I used to wear a suit faithfully in those days.
Three-piece?
No, it wasn't three-piece. I didn't follow my old econ prop. But Walter used to say I looked like a banker in a suit. So one day, on days I wasn't teaching, I might wear pants from the suit or a good-looking pair of slacks and a shirt and tie and maybe a sweater. So one day I'm wearing a shirt and tie and a sweater, and I got a call to go over to the president's office. I don't know what he wanted to talk to me about, but it wasn't very exciting. But as I went in, he says, we're pretty informal, aren't we? I said, I'm not teaching today. Oh, well, then that's okay.
So there was a dress code.
Yeah. But just unspoken.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What, those first years were you, what courses, do you remember what courses you were teaching, or was it just introductory?
I taught beginning economics, I taught intermediate price theory, I taught national income accounting, not how to aggregate the gross national product, etc., but how the Commerce Department goes about compiling the national income statistics. That was the course. I had taken a course in that at Yale, and mm-hmm. somebody thought it would be nice to have. I think I only taught it once. It's kind of a ridiculous.
And at the time,
course around something like that.
Mm-hmm. So did you have a blend of large classes, small classes, or were they mostly?
Actually, in those days, even beginning economics was only about 35 or 40 people.
Okay.
Yeah, they were all what we would now call
small classes.
Small classes. So beginning econ, labor economics, which was really labor relations, the way I taught it. That one time I taught that, and then labor law. We used to teach three classes a term and didn't think we were overburdened at all in those days.
Mm-hmm. And you came as an assistant professor, you said?
I came as an assistant prof.
Without tenure?
Without tenure. Mm-hmm. But get this. As soon as I got here, I said to myself, I'm going to have to start research and publish something, because I realized. And later, when I became FGO, I couldn't believe how many people didn't seem to realize that's what you had to do to survive in a university. But God, there was never a shortage of.
One's a given, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I cast around for something to work on. I was half-time in the labor school and half-time in economics. But I wasn't in the research branch of the labor school. Mm-hmm. I was teaching classes for union members on how to handle grievances and things like that. Utterly boring. But anyway, I figured I'm going to have to publish something. So what should I work on? I made up a list of about 10 possible topics, any one of which I was willing to plunge into. And one of them had to do with the fact that the St. Lawrence Seaway was going to open in a year or two after I got here. And I figured when I discovered that the people working on these ore boats in the Great Lakes and the longshoremen and the ports were all either non-union or they were in a company union. So I figured when these ocean-going ships come into the Great Lakes, they're going to be carrying union crews. They're going to carry the union message in here, and this is all going to change. So I figured that'd be a good topic. Study labor relations, maritime labor relations on the Great Lakes. So that was one of the 10, and I went to the, Jack Stieber was the associate director for research, and he was in the econ department too. So I went to him and I said, I've got these projects. If there's any one of these that the labor school would like me to work on, I'm perfectly happy to do that. And he said, well, I think that one on the Great Lakes, that'd be a good subject. So I, in connection with that, I went down to Washington to do some work in the Library of Congress, and I, in the course of it, somehow I wound up over in the Commerce Department talking to a man who had been a Great Lakes ship captain, and he was their expert on labor relations, this guy, and he was about ready to retire. And so I interviewed him to get some information from him about the Lake Carriers Association and their policies and all that. And I think I made sure he knew I'd already published a book on the longshoring industry. And so we got along quite well. So I got back here about a week after I got back, I got a call from him saying he had just been given an assignment that he wasn't qualified to fill, and he couldn't find anybody in the Labor Department who would claim to know anything about the longshoring industry. But he says, I know that you do. So he said, my assignment is this. He said, the International Labor Organization, are you familiar with that?
The
ILO is a branch of the UN.
Okay.
It was a part of the League of Nations, one of the only agencies that survived, I think. Well, anyway, they hold conferences from time to time concerning various industries, and they were going to hold a conference in Geneva, Switzerland, and I think there were about 140 countries involved, and each country was to send to this conference a representative of management in that country of labor and a public member. And so his job, and the people who organized this conference, which was going to have to do with productivity in ports, cargo handling in ports, they had put together a list of something like 200 questions, many of which had to do with collective bargaining in these various countries. And then the delegates from each country were to participate in the discussions, and then they were going to issue a report based on these discussions and how these 200 questions were answered. And so he said to me, I'd really appreciate it if you would help me on this. And he said, I could either come up there for a couple of weeks or you could come here. So I said, well, why don't I come down there, because then the Labor Department is right there. There are representatives in Washington of the unions in the longshoring industry and the employers and all that. So I did. I went down there and spent a couple of weeks, and we prepared the answers to all these questions. And then these answers were submitted to the U.S. Department of Labor, U.S. Department of State, and the Defense Department. And this was because the defense had an interest in improving cargo handling in ports. In Vietnam, for example, they didn't have docks. You drop anchor out in the stream somewhere and then you unload onto barges and so on. So the Defense Department had an interest in it. The State Department did, because ports involve treaties among different countries which have ships going in and out of those ports. And the Labor Department, for obvious reasons, I guess. So the report was completed, and I brought this to the attention of my department head. So after I had been here about 3 months, the department was looking around for somebody to put up for promotion, because a couple of years had gone by and they hadn't been able to put anybody up, and they figured, here's a guy who's got a book out published by University of California Press. He's an advisor to three departments of the U.S. government. On paper, it looks tremendous. So they put me up, and I think in 4 months, I was an associate prof with tenure. Mm-hmm. And I've been milking that ever since. But see, there's a case where you make, you break, you're lucky as hell that things happen just at that time. But in a way, you make it too,
because
you have some control over yourself. A lot of people let other influences determine their lives, and they just push this way and push that way. Mm-hmm. And I was determined not to let that happen to me.
But the other thing, it seems to me, that is people's attitude to research. It sounded like you saw research as an opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
And both for learning and advancing. You weren't afraid of it.
No, that's right. Yeah. And I had subjects I was fascinated by, and it was fun to talk to people. The New York experience was really something. While I was working on this, there was a huge investigation of racketeering in the waterfront. And I met the priest, if you saw the film On the Waterfront.
Uh-huh.
There was a Catholic priest involved, Father Corrigan. I met him, and I rode up one time from New York to New Haven on the train with him. And having been raised a Catholic, you know, I felt a little uncomfortable being with a priest. As soon as the train got out of the station, he says, "What do you think about a drink?" I was tempted to say, "You mean holy water?" So we had several old fashions on the way up. But one of my interviews was with a guy who went by the name of Tough Tony Anastasia, the brother of Albert Anastasia. Is that a familiar name?
Mm-hmm. Not to me, but...
Well, you've ever heard of an outfit called Murder Incorporated?
Oh, yeah, yes, yes.
Well, he was referred to in the papers as the Lord High Executioner of Murder Incorporated.
Okay.
And his brother, that's Albert, his brother was the head of the Longshore Union in Brooklyn. And he was probably the most liberal union official in the East Coast Longshoremen's Union, which didn't require much, but he was. So I went over to interview him in his headquarters over there. I had to wait. We made an appointment for, let's say, 2 o'clock. He wasn't there. So I waited outside, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden here came about six big burly guys, all dressed like they came off a set of a Hollywood movie. Wide brimmed hats, long overcoats, you know, practically to the floor. And they're surrounding a guy who's built about the size of Jim Hoffa, senior, about 5'7" maybe, strong as a bull. But he's in the center. These are his bodyguards. So somebody, they all went on past and back into the back somewhere. And one of these guys came out and he said, "You're the guy waiting to see you, Tony?" And I said, "Yeah." So he said, "Come on." We go back. We get into an office about the size of this, but it's dark. And he's sitting at a huge desk. And over in the corner was one of these bodyguards who stayed there the whole time we're talking. So I feel that made me just a little bit uncomfortable. But... anyway, we had a pleasant enough interview, and I sort of praised him for some of the things that I read about him doing with the union. And then he said, "You know," he says, "I can't understand it." He says, "The papers are always, whenever they write about me, they say, 'And he's the brother of Albert Anastasia.' He says, 'Why don't they mention my brother Gerardo? He's a Jesuit.'" And then I want to give you something. Mm-hmm. He pulls out of his desk a big 8x11 photograph of himself at Christmas time dispensing presents to little kids in the neighborhood with moms, big busty moms behind him. I don't know what I did with that photograph.
He gave you that picture?
He gave it to me. I said, "How about autographing it?" So he did. Anthony Anastasia. But I told some people, some New Yorkers who were grad students with me at Yale about that, and they said, "My God, you went down there? You could have been killed." I said, "Oh, shit, they wouldn't kill a young grad student coming around." Actually, I had the feeling Tony was pretty impressed with the fact that I was paying attention to him.
Some of the things when after you got back, did ultimately that any of that research, did you publish that?
You mean the...
On the Maritime, the Great Lakes Maritime?
Oh, yeah, I've got a little paperback. One of the artists in the press did a nice sketch of an ore carrier coming down the canal or wherever it was. And then somehow I got a cartoon from the New Yorker showing a farmer who's looking up at one of these ore carriers, you know, going down the canal there. And I forget, I think the captain's asking for directions or something. This is when the Seaway just opened up.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, they're immense anyway, but to be down on the ground, looking up, boy, you're really impressed with how huge those things are. Mm. Yeah, I've published a little, we didn't sell very many. I was left with an overstocked supply of those things. Mm. But several people have written and asked for it. Used it in research they were doing about labor relations on the Great Lakes. And a couple of years ago, some guy who was an official of the East Coast Longshore Union, which represents people on some of these Great Lakes ports, he asked me if I could send him something like 8 copies of this thing, and I think that exhausted what I had left, so I sent him. I never heard from him, of course.
When
those things got good reviews, though, which I was quite gratified. Mm-hmm.
In the late 1950s and early 1960s, how would you describe the students at that time here at Michigan
State?
Quite
a bit like they are now, I think. Not all that interested in studies or pursuing knowledge for its own sake or whatever, sort of the way I was.
I'm
more interested in social life and drinking beer and having fun. That was the impression. But pleasant, and they seemed to respect the faculty a lot more than students did. I retired in 1989, and by that time, faculty members were not getting the kind of respect they did back in the 50s. But they weren't a very interesting group of students to teach, I didn't think. Mm-hmm. Picked up a lot in the 60s. I look back on the 60s. See, I started teaching at the University of Washington. I taught a course there, too, as a grad student. So I started in about 47. And in all those years, 47 to 89, the 60s and early 70s were the most exciting for me. People would challenge you, you know, they'd say, where are you coming from? First day of class or something. Mm-hmm. It would take me an hour to answer that question.
What would you say was the source of that activism? What brought about the change from the 50s?
I think the becoming aware of the racial discrimination and the activities that surrounded the civil rights movement, which didn't touch Michigan State all that much, but I think that started it. And then what SDS was founded over here at Port Huron, you know, or Lake Huron. And then they got into the war, took over their interest pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Did you have early contacts with the Students for Democratic Society?
I was their advisor for a while.
On campus?
Yeah.
Did they approach you, or did you, how that, do you remember that?
But before I forget, I wanted to tell you about an experience I had with the campus NAACP, which tells us something about the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You remember the incident down at Central High School in Little Rock, where the troops had been sent down by President Eisenhower? That would have been mid-50s, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, President Hanna Hanna became the chairman of the Civil Rights Commission in the Eisenhower years, and he invited a guy whose name escapes me for the moment now, but who was one of the boys in that group of blacks who had to be protected to go to Central High School. His name will come back to me now. Ernest Green.
Mm-hmm.
That was the guy. He came here, and so sometime in about 59 or thereabouts, I was asked I used to talk about discrimination in my labor class. I brought in all kinds of subjects that somebody could easily have challenged me by asking, what's that got to do with economics? You know, and I'd say, look, it has to do with a broad environment. I was fully prepared to be attacked on that, and some people were in those days. But I was disappointed. I never was. But because I talked about that, I think must have been the reason. So the black students formed an NAACP branch on the campus, and Ernie was the chairman of it. Now, at that time, I think there was one black faculty member who was in the English department who was tight with Hannah, but who didn't want to have anything to do with NAACP. He just wanted to maintain a low profile, as we'd say nowadays, this guy. Mm-hmm. And then there was a black grad student in, I think, education. But that was about it, so far as faculty and staff go. So one day, Ernie, or one of the people from this NAACP branch, asked me would I meet with them over at the Union Building. And so I go over there, and there are about, 15 young black students there. So they invited me to join them in this, sitting around the circle. So I did, and they said, we've discovered that to have a registered student organization, we have to have a faculty sponsor, so would you be interested in doing that? I said, yeah, sure. But I said, I better put you on notice. I said, here's my attitude. If we organize a branch, I will consider this as a do-nothing branch until President Hannah attacks us for something we're doing. And they literally moved back. They said, would you mind going up on the, balcony there, or whatever the hell that was, concourse, while we discuss this? And, okay. So I think I could see them talking animatedly, but I couldn't hear them. I think it took them half an hour before they finally decided. They called me back and said, we've decided we'd like you to be our faculty sponsor, so fine. Well, one condition I laid down was, I'm not going to come to your meetings. I'm not going to look over your shoulder to see that you're handling your finances properly. I won't give you any advice. You're adults. You don't need it from me. If I make a mistake and offer it, reject it, but I don't think I will. So what I will do is what you asked me to do, and that's mostly sign papers for various things where you have to have a signature. Well, a few weeks later, they had discovered that the black students couldn't rent a room in East Lansing, much less buy a house or anything. It was really lily white in those days. So they did what you do in a situation like that. In order to test the existence of discrimination, they would send a black student. They see an ad in the state news or posted at the housing office or something. They send a black student to see if he or she could rent a room. And landlady or landlord say, oh, sorry, it's just been taken. Too bad. So they go, then here comes the white students, because they had some white kids in the group too. Oh, love to have you. Here's what the rent's going to be. So they reported this, and sure enough, Hannah, here he was, the head of the Civil Rights Commission. He held hearings in Mississippi and elsewhere. He denounced this as a dirty trick. He was embarrassed that students at Michigan State would do anything as underhanded as that. And that's just, that's a standard procedure for identifying discrimination. So I figured, this is a pretty good outfit.
So it wasn't long after you were advisor that that this happened?
Yeah, so I felt pretty good about that. And there was one occasion, one of the things they did that was really kind of fun, I think it was 1960, the National NAACP asked its branches all around the country, including campus branches, to picket northern branches of chain stores that operated in the South and wouldn't let a black person sit at the counter and have a cup of coffee or a hamburger or something. To picket the northern branches, get publicity, put pressure that way on these chains. Well, there was a branch right across from Berkey Hall of some national chain. I don't know what the hell, Kresge or some such outfit. So we decided we'd picket there. So we're picketing, and we're going around a kind of an oval shape like this. And when we came to a certain point, here was a guy taking our mugshot, just like this close. So somebody in the group, there were a few faculty members, but mostly students. And then there was, this is a side issue. You might enjoy it. I was living in a duplex at that time, and there was a woman who lived in the other part, who worked for a real estate firm here. So she was coming out of this door and saw me there and wondering what the hell we were doing. She didn't approve of it. So, but in order to carry on a conversation, she walked alongside of me as if she were picketing. She caught all kinds of hell from her boss when her picture appeared.
She got her picture taken.
And then she was telling me I was wrong to do this. But anyway, somebody in this group said, you know, that guy who's taking our pictures, he's a campus cop in clothes, plain clothes. Mm-hmm. So we went over to the police station, which was in a Quonset hut in those days, and they had a counter, and then the officers were back ways. So we asked if we could talk to Art Brandstetter. He was the chief of police and the head of police administration at that time. Could we see him? So he came out to this counter. He didn't invite us back into his office. He came out to the counter and, you know, asked what we wanted, and we said, we want to protest you're sending one of your police officers over there to take our photographs, and why are you doing it? He says, well, in the first place, he says, that if anybody took your picture, it certainly wasn't a member of my staff. So while we're talking, in comes the guy. His name was Hank.